Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal for September 9th, 2004. I'm Amy Brown here in the studio. Co-host Meredith DeFrancesco will be reporting in from New York City. Today we continue our coverage of the massive protests and record-breaking numbers of arrests in New York City during the Republican convention last week. By the time the Republican convention convened last week, preemptive attempts to intimidate anyone opposed to the Republicans were already in full swing. Undercover police infiltrated local and national groups whose members planned to attend the protests. Weeks before the convention, it was disclosed that dozens of people had been each assigned a team of undercover police to monitor all of their activities. As justification, they were called anarchists. On the Friday night before the convention, thousands of people turned out for a critical mass bike ride through the city. At first, the ride went smoothly, and those participating got friendly waves and support from spectators along the route. And then suddenly, the police brought out rolls of orange plastic netting and used it to encircle bike riders at several locations. As police made hundreds of arrests and injured several people in the process, New Yorkers poured out into the streets, calling out support for the protesters and chanting anti-Bush slogans. And unless you live in New York City or use independent media to get your news, it's unlikely that you heard about this. On Sunday, the day before the convention started, at least 500,000 people took to the streets to express opposition to the Bush regime for a wide variety of reasons. Among them were military people who just returned from Iraq and were opposed to the war, World Trade Center survivors, and ordinary New Yorkers who'd never attended a protest before but were at this one because they were outraged that the Republicans were capitalizing on the anniversary of 9/11 by holding the convention there. The New York Times and even an unofficial police source estimated that 500,000 people attended the protest, making it possibly the largest protest in the city's history. Despite that, there was minimal coverage in the corporate media. Monday, the day the convention started, groups of young people and poor people and their supporters took to the streets. And that evening, as thousands attended a march to Madison Square Garden, the site of the convention, where welfare rights groups planned to try to present a warrant for the arrest of George W. Bush for crimes against humanity, the march was proceeding peacefully for blocks, but just before it reached the convention site, the police quickly surrounded groups of people with metal barricades, recognizing this as a common precursor that police use right before they do mass arrests. People started to panic and tried to escape from the barricades so that they could leave. There had been no order to disperse given, so people were just trying to leave peacefully. Immediately, police on horses and scooters charged into the crowd, and there were more arrests and injuries that night. The next day, August 31st, was designated as a direct action day. Affinity groups held protests and engaged in civil disobedience all over the city, and our guest today will have more to say about that. By the end of the day, police were randomly arresting people standing in public areas like the library steps. In one instance, a group was going to hang a banner near the front of the New York City Public Library, and the police said they couldn't hang a banner, so they asked if they could just hold the banner, and the police said yes, and as soon as they unfurled the banner and held it up, they were jumped on and arrested. There were other seemingly random arrests there as well. Later that evening, as Jenna and Barbara Bush giggled and Arnold called us economic girly men, the police systematically cleared the streets around the convention of protesters and locals alike by arresting close to 2,000 people in a matter of minutes and then transporting them to a makeshift holding center that was filled with toxic chemicals. There, just as in Philadelphia at the Republican convention 4 years earlier, the law enforcement officials attempted to keep everyone in jail until the convention was over. We'll pick up from there with our guest today and with Meredith, who's reporting in from New York. Meredith, are you there?
Yes, I am.
And you're going to go ahead and introduce our first guest?
Yes. We have with us today Daniel L. Offerman, a civil rights lawyer for 35 years and a member of the National Lawyers Guild for 30. He was one of the many lawyers legally supporting demonstrators at the Republican National Convention protests, both on the streets and in the courtroom, though, as we'll discuss, their access to jail demonstrators was denied. Welcome, Daniel.
Welcome. Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Can you bring us up to date on the charges the city is facing for their actions, the question
yes.
legality of the arrests and charges faced by the protesters.
Yes, I can. A judge, Emily Jane Goodman, and on Wednesday night, when it became clear to us that the number of people were being kept in jail in excess of a state court ruling that they should be kept in there for 24 hours and not be given desk appearance tickets, which means that most people get released within 2 to 6 hours. When that became clear to us, we attempted to get the judge to issue a writ of habeas corpus, only to find out that the police department and the corporation council had already picked a hand-picked judge, Judge Cataldo, and when we were with Judge Goodman, she issued an order allowing us, after argument with the corporation council, access to our clients in jail so that at least we could tell the clients that the help was on their way and we would be able to make contact with their loved ones and partners, etc. The police department refused to allow us access to our clients that night, and the following day our case went before Judge Cataldo, who ordered the city to release people in segments depending upon how long that they had been incarcerated. The first bunch of people, 120, was supposed to be released at 1:30 p.m. The second bunch, 350, who had been in jail for 30 hours, was supposed to be released by 3 o'clock. And the third bunch, by 5 o'clock, was another 90 people that had been incarcerated at least 24 hours. Those were the city's own numbers and come from a sheet that existed and was created indicating the number of people in jail at the courthouse ready to be released, arraigned, or otherwise dealt with. We're not even talking about the people at the Pier 57, which is indeed, as your introduction said, correct, insofar as it had been designated previously as an asbestos-laden site and was also a bus terminal storage facility. And when I was in my 20s and worked as a merchant seaman, was used as a pier for the U.S. lines and the big ship, the passenger ship of the United States, in the middle 60s. What happened was the judge found that the city had violated his order to release those people, and by 6 o'clock found that there had been 3 specific instances of willful violation of the court's order and found the city in contempt. Finally, the city got the picture and started releasing people, and by 11 o'clock on Thursday night had released a majority of the people in jail so that only a few remained who were, I think, released and arraigned the following morning. Now, what's significant about that is that the for the first time in at least my memory, the city of New York had been found to be held in contempt for their willful violation of a court order. Two is that the mayor and the police commissioner had been touting the fact that the city of New York was ready for to process up to 1,000 arrests per day during the demonstration week when the Republicans were here, and obviously their complaints that they couldn't process 1,200 arrests were not at least believable. The additional stuff that was coming out was that the police were telling our clients that they wouldn't be out until George Bush left town, which was entirely consistent with the actions of the police department, because 81% of all these people arrested were arrested for disorderly conduct. A lot more of them were arrested because they simply got caught up in the preventive actions by the police, who went back on agreements and netted people and otherwise treated them like fish in a barrel, which was particularly, you know, which means, at least to me, that who would want to demonstrate if you know you're going to get locked up for 48 to 60 hours?
Someone called it the mass arrest form of crowd control.
I think that's not a bad analysis. It's the first time in my memory that this kind of thing has been used. Anyway, judge held them in contempt and ordered us back to court this morning, and this morning issued an order formally charging, ordering them to show cause why they shouldn't be held in contempt. Gave them until tomorrow afternoon at 4:30, 4 o'clock, to turn over to us all documents, because all these documents that the city has created will demonstrate how many people were actually in violation, how many people were actually subject to the violation of the court order because they were held beyond 24 hours. The city probably is not going to comply with that, and then ordered us back on Monday for another hearing to determine when and how and under what circumstances this proof will come in. So the judge is holding his line, though it would seem to me that he's under enormous pressure from the city. The Corporation Counsel himself, which is the supervising attorney for more than 500 lawyers in the legal department, as well as Mayor Bloomberg, as well as the police chief, has gone on record as saying that the city did nothing wrong. But in reality, Mayor Bloomberg has been releasing statements like, well, what did you expect, Club Med, when people are complaining about the conditions at the Pier 57? And I've seen hundreds of people come out of these detention facilities with oil on their clothing and wheezing and coughing. If you complained about medical care, you were told that it would delay your release. And essentially, when people that had minor were arrested for demonstration type arrests were treated more harshly than people that were accused of rapes, robberies, assaults, and burglaries.
I'm thinking that we're going to have to end that update there because we're going to be talking to two more guests,
okay,
or organizers during. But we thank you very much for the update, and we know this is continuing.
Thank you.
And that was Daniel Alterman of the National Lawyers Guild. And before we go on to our next guest, we wanted to play a few minutes of some of the sound that Meredith and I recorded during the chaos created by the police at the end of the march Tuesday evening. First, you're going to hear my description of what was happening at 28th and 8th, and then you'll hear Meredith, who was a block away, describing what she saw and asking one of the police on the scene about what was happening. As we pass by different buildings here, people are looking out and waving and giving thumbs up and lots of support. So the crowd has been chanting, "Join us." They just threw up a barricade behind us, and some people managed to make it past the barricade. And police are making arrests at the barricade.
People are chanting, "Let us go."
People are trying to escape from the pen. The police are just pushing into the crowds. It's like they're getting the barricade down. Oh. Cops just shoved me out of the way. Sorry. Yeah, sorry. Hey, the cops are just arresting people at the barricade and throwing people onto the ground. It's hard to see what the hell's going on here. It's just all just went nuts all of a sudden. Oh, they're taking down the barricades over here on the sidewalk now to let people through this way. Now we've got horse
shit,
police
shit,
up here.
Shit, shit. Go.
Okay, get
them. Shit.
God, they're using the horses now.
And there's more helicopters in the sky. There's 2 or 3 helicopters in the sky. There's some people laying down doing the non-cooperative thing on the ground.
There's more over there, though, because they're moving all the time.
Yeah, they're driving us down this street, apparently.
A lot of people arrested.
Cops on motorcycles have got us flattened up against the wall. And they're getting really close to us. A whole line of them. I'm gonna get out of here. But all of a sudden the cops just cage everybody in it, and I've heard they've been snatching people.
They're not snatching them in crowds like this.
What?
Well, I saw somebody get shoved by a cop with a fence. I saw a cop shoving a girl with a fence very violently. So I was one. There were.
I couldn't tell you. You might want to go over there and ask.
That's why I asked you for an example of earlier, if you knew, because I know you didn't.
There
were
no problems earlier.
Anything. That's what they're saying, protesters.
No, I think, as Julianne was saying last night, they were just like snatch people out of the middle of the crowd, and then people get pissed off and they surround the whole group and arrest them all.
Okay, and that's some of the sound that we recorded at the conclusion of one of the many protests that happened during the Republican convention last week, and another thing that you surely didn't hear about on the corporate media. And we have other guests with us on the phone, and Meredith reporting in from New York City. And over to you, Meredith.
Yeah, great. We have now with us by phone from New York City, Frida Berrigan, who is on the board of the War Resisters League and was one of the organizers of a direct action at the RNC last week, and Tim Doody, one of the organizers with the A31 Coalition, who organized the August 31st day of direct action. Welcome to you both.
Welcome.
Thank you. Tim, let's start with you as one of the organizers with the A31 Coalition, of which many were a part. Why a day of direct action and civil disobedience? Indeed, the week was filled with it.
Well, basically, a lot of us felt that, you know, for the last 4 years with the Bush administration, we've tried petitioning, we've tried lobbying. We even organized the largest protest ever on February 15th, 2003, and Bush dismissed this as nothing more than a focus group. And a lot of us felt that, you know, the solutions are out there. We just need to create platforms for them to be heard. And one way to do that would be to, you know, create a public relations crisis through civil disobedience in the streets during the Republican National Convention.
Can you give a quick overview of some of the actions that did take place? There were many creative actions from street musical street parades and parties to events at various locations around the city. Can you give a quick overview of some of the actions?
Sure. You know, we had actions throughout the day. At 7:30 a.m., there was students had gotten together and painted their faces to look like death masks to represent those lost in what they called imperialist wars, and rode the subways throughout New York City. In addition, in front of the Bureau of Immigrant and Customs Enforcement at the federal building, a lot of groups from Philadelphia came out to protest the treatment of immigrant detainees who are often held without adequate legal representation, and in some cases their loved ones aren't even notified at all that they are still in fact in custody and are just reported as missing. In addition, of course, Frida Berrigan's group, the War Resisters League, had a die-in and a procession from Ground Zero to Madison Square Garden, which I'm sure she'll talk more about later. And other groups such as Code Pink held a shut-up-a-thon in honor of Bill O'Reilly outside of the Fox News, kind of playing with his most famous utterance to people with dissident views on his show. And, you know, I mean, the thing that was pretty amazing about it, I guess, was that, you know, throughout the day, I mean, you know, like I said, it began at 7:30 a.m., and I was arrested at 7:30 p.m. We were having a street party with two complete anarchist marching bands headed up to Madison Square Garden, and the police cordoned everyone off and arrested us all. And I was like, oh, you know, I was worried. Oh, no, you know, this thing was supposed to go on a bit longer. And I remember my handcuffs, you know, were on. They were a little too tight, but I used my shoulders and my elbows and joints. I didn't even know I had to check the text messages on my cell phone, kind of angling my arms around to pull it out. And an hour and a half after my arrest at 9 p.m., I looked at the text messages that were coming in. And at that point, activists had blocked a busload of Missouri delegates. And 2 hours later, while we were still sitting on the bus waiting to be processed, I managed to move my phone from my pocket into my lap again and was able to look. And, in fact, you know, people were still sitting down on the streets near the garden and being arrested. So, you know, we vowed to create a dialogue on the streets, and I think we did that. I think Mayor Bloomberg, Karl Rove, and others really sought to create
a bubble around the Republican National Convention, and I think we penetrated this bubble consistently throughout August 31st.
One of the things that I just real quickly I want to insert that we haven't mentioned is the use of the text messaging system that was pretty unique to this protest, how widespread it was. Everyone in the city just about who had a cell phone, who was in any way interested in this, was getting constant updates via text message about what was going on at any point of the city, where there were arrests happening, where there were different things that people could be going to, and that was keeping people organized in a real decentralized kind of way.
Let's talk to Frieda Berrigan about the action that you worked on with the War Resisters League and what that message was.
Sure, Meredith. The War Resisters League really wanted to be out in the streets on August 31st and a part of this day of direct action. We wanted to stay very focused on the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, the lives that have been lost. As your listeners know, we just passed the 1,000 U.S. troop mark recently and have lost more than 1,000 troops in Iraq. And we were particularly galled and horrified by the Republicans' use of Ground Zero, use of the site of the former World Trade Centers as a backdrop and as a justification for their war without end policies that have been so costly and had such dire consequences for us here in America and for people throughout the world. So what we conceived to do was to vigil at Ground Zero for an hour on August 31st to mourn the loss of those 3,000 lives on September 11th, 2001, and then march north to deliver a message to the delegates at the Republican Convention. And the message was no more Ground Zeros, no more Ground Zeros in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in every community in the United States that has lost a son or a daughter in uniform. And we wanted to deliver that message directly to the Republicans. And after seeing former Mayor Giuliani and others on the stage at the Republican convention the night before we did our direct action, we were even more committed that this was a really good way to get our message across. What we planned to do was do a die-in, to dress in white, a color of mourning, to carry the names of those who have been killed in the Bush administration's wars throughout the world, and then do a die-in as close to the convention as we could get. Our aim, of course, was to do it at the feet of the Republicans on the floor of the convention. We knew we wouldn't get that far. But given how sort of nutty the day was with more than 200 of our activists being arrested preemptively at the beginning of the march at Ground Zero, we were really heartened and surprised and excited that we were able to get to 28th Street and Broadway, just a few blocks from Madison Square Garden, and do our die-in to hold that space, to block traffic for more than an hour, to deliver a clear message of no more Ground Zeros in our name.
Let's ask you both, as the time is wrapping up, how this day of action, or this week of action, fits into a larger movement of demonstrations and actions that of dissent in this country and globally that are unafraid of using direct action, and how you how this organizing, this infrastructure that you set up for the RNC over these months and your coming leading up to it, where do you feel that fits in, and where are we going from here? Do you want to start with that, Tim?
Okay, sure. In the call to action for the for August 31st, one of the things we declared that we wanted to help take democracy back from the Halliburtons and the Enrons and bring it to the community boards, the schools, and the town halls. And that won't happen in a day. You know, it just doesn't work that quickly. But nonetheless, I think this day was significant. It was a step in that direction. I think we can consider August 31st, in fact, the whole week, you know, I think, during a protest during the Republican National Convention, I think we can sum it up by calling it all the people's impeachment. And, you know, it was a significant week, and I think it's a step toward taking more direct control over our resources, our air, our pensions, and, you know, and the future of our communities, and taking it out of the hands of the people that are doing it mostly for profit over people.
Great. Frida?
Yeah, I think when the president can write off millions of people in the streets as a focus group, this experiment in indirect action, experiment in civil disobedience that we had in the streets during the Republican convention was really a wake-up call and a beginning, an initiation, maybe a trial by fire, given how harsh the conditions in New York City jails were. But all of those people who were arrested during the convention, I think, were radicalized, were sort of brought to the next step. And I think our task now is to build on that, that initial radicalization, to carry us through this election season and into sort of a new era of civil disobedience, a new era of direct action for direct democracy, for all of the things that Tim mentioned, and to sort of take back our government and take back our resources that have been plundered in these wars abroad, and to be able to define security ourselves, to define it, and not allow the Bushes of the world to define it as these war policies abroad. So I'm very excited about the next steps that we have to take as a movement, as many movements, for peace and justice and equality.
That's a good place to leave off.
Thank you very much, Frida Berrigan with the War Resisters League, Tim Duty with the A31 Coalition. Thank you both.
Thank you.
All right, thanks a lot.
Bye.
And for more information, one of the places that you can check online is www.nyc.indymedia.org. You've been listening to Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal with Amy Brown and Meredith DeFrancesco. Joel Mann engineered today's program. Andy Buckley does web and technical support. Our email address is radioactive@mainindymedia.org, and our website is freespeech.org/RAN. Thanks for listening and acting. Stay tuned for Hightower and Free Speech Radio News, and please join us again next Thursday at 4 for Radioactive.